Hello, I'm Mariette Snyman, a journalist devoted to uncovering new ways to understand ourselves, deepen our relationships, and strengthen our emotional well-being. Thank you for tuning into Calm, Clear, and Helpful, the weekly podcast series introducing you to wellness professionals offering their expertise and assistance. Today's topic is for business founders, how to dissolve subconscious conflicts. If you're familiar with the challenges faced by being a business founder, including pressures from within and demands from the outside world, I trust this episode will bring you renewed perspective. The professional I'm introducing today is Alta Renz, counseling psychologist, team leader, leadership development consultant, and trauma-informed practitioner from Suffolk in England. Welcome, Alta.
Hello, Marietta. So lovely to be able to speak to you after looking at all those wonderful podcasts that you do.
Thank you. You have a multifaceted career spanning more than 30 years on different continents. Do tell us more.
Yes. Well, it's one of those things where you end up exploring the world inadvertently. And I almost think that when I think about where I've been and what I've done, it's a little bit of circumstantial stuff. On the one hand, in that, you know, I think I might have mentioned to you, we had some young kids and I was worried about their own safety. So we left South Africa and went to the US of A. And that was a major change for me because I had to learn all sorts of new things. Mm-hmm. And ended up working in the school system. So that was my intro to working in the school system. And then from there, things just progressed. So I was recruited by New Zealand to come and work in the school system there, which is what I did for many years. And then eventually decided that I would prefer to return to, you know, pure therapeutic work. And I started to get involved in working with trauma. So that's roughly where I've been. And now I've done some changes again.
Yeah.
As one does over a long lifetime.
Yeah, would you like to tell us about your current focus?
Well, as you know, my focus now is on leadership. It's not a new focus. Okay. I came into this after spending many years in special education classrooms where you learn fast that no two brains work the same way and no amount of authority gets a team moving if the wiring underneath isn't understood. And so working across Johnson County schools in North Carolina and later in New Zealand, I built multidisciplinary teams out of specialists who all spoke different professional languages and had to find a way to get them pulling together. Along the way, I picked up specialist training in neuroscience, and it changed how I think about people entirely. So that interest in the psychology underneath leadership is what draws me in particular to founders. So it's not purely academic. I started several businesses myself over the years from a photo lab. I started off in personal development training and then in my own psychological practice. So I know the demands of building something from nothing firsthand. I think you do too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what I've noticed, both in my own experience and in people close to me, both my kids are founders, is that founders carry a particular kind of pressure, the need to earn, the investor expectations, there's a fear of failure, a fear of not being good enough, and a loneliness that comes with a position that most people never see. That pressure interacts with patterns people are already carrying and often shaped in their early lives. And what it does is it quietly undermines the very success that they are chasing. So for me, leadership development for founders isn't just about strategy or skill. It's about understanding what's driving the behavior beneath the role, so those patterns don't end up running the show.
I'm so grateful we're talking about this, Alta, because I think you've really put it in a nutshell. As I said in the intro, the internal pressures, in combination with the demands from the outside world. And when I read a little about what you have written and looked at your website, it really struck me that although you have now pivoted once again to focus on another direction more in depth, I can see that what you have been doing for so many decades has all led you here.
Absolutely. And as I say, you know, this is, I'm not just looking at theory. I've been through these things myself. In fact, doing a pivot is already going back into a founder position. And you know the impact that it has on you and the amount of self-searching that you do in the process. And then, as I say, I've closely followed some of the founders associated with my children, and I can see that everyone starts from a place of real conviction. They see something that the rest of the world hasn't caught up to yet, and they're willing to bet absolutely everything on it. So early on, that conviction carries them, and it fuels the long hours, the sacrifices, the relentless problem solving. Right?
Right.
I think you can identify with that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Would you like to mention some general reasons for starting a business, just to give us a place to launch our conversation from?
Well, general reasons. I mean, for a lot of us, we're in the workplace and we're working for people. And you will have seen, you know, there's been quite a lot of talk recently about psychological safety in the workplace and how people are managed within the workplace. And so often there is that this is not good enough. I can see things that need to be done differently, or I can see better ways that something can be done. And then that becomes the motivator to get out there and to get involved in something different. That certainly has been a huge motivator for me through the years, but I can see that that's the same thing that happens for a lot of other people. And I think you have to have a real conviction in order to do that. You have to be able to see something that the rest of the world hasn't caught up to yet, and then willing to place your bet that you're going to get into this and you're going to make it work.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there has to be that conviction.
Yeah.
And with it comes many long hours, lots of sacrifices along the way, right?
Right.
I'm sure you've experienced that, but if you just look around what people are writing about, you can see it so clearly.
Absolutely. Now, Alta, let's look at underlying psychological drives related to starting a business.
So I'm going to take it back to founders. So you can see that underneath that drive, a lot of those founders are carrying pressures that never make it into any pitch deck they might be presenting. There's a real need to earn. That's the most obvious one financially, to keep your head above the water. But there's also a sense of proving that they deserve the role they've taken on. So there's pressure from investors. There's wanting growth on a timeline that doesn't always match reality. There's the fear of failure, which for many isn't really about the business at all. It's tied to a deeper fear of not being good enough. And there's the loneliness of the position, the sense that no one else really understands the weight they're carrying. To their team, their family, and their investors, they're expected to be the stellar one, the one who's going to make it happen, the one who's going to be the steady one. All of those kinds of things are tied into this. So that's the internal pressure. But what that starts to do is it starts to activate those patterns that they carry from earlier life, their ways of coping with pressure, of proving their wealth, of avoiding failure, that were shaped long before the business ever existed. And under normal conditions, those patterns can quietly sit in the background. They can be hidden. But the intensity of founding a company puts a magnifying glass on them, and they start to shape their decisions in ways that the founders can't see from the inside. That's where the BWRT stuff that I work with comes in. Because, well, actually, psychology in general, but BWRT looks at the fact that a lot of those decisions are made out of normal consciousness, and we're not aware of that. So, yeah, that's the big point.
Yeah. If you say out of consciousness, you mean, do you mean that it is subconsciously driven?
It's absolutely, it's subconsciously driven. So we know now that information fed into the reptilian complex is matched with existing patterns that have been built up previously in life. And those patterns are there because they're actually an automated kind of a process that gets established, because it saved you previously. If you experienced something that was very negative earlier in life and you found a way to cope with it, whatever that pattern may be, then your body tells you that this is a safe pattern to repeat. And even though those patterns may not be useful for you later in life, they continue to repeat.
Yes, especially when you become a founder. Would you like to discuss some of these, I think one can call them psychological difficulties, that you encounter in your practice when working with founders and other business people?
Sure. There's quite a bit that comes in here. So for most of them, there's some issues around identity, fusion with business. So the company stops being something they run and it becomes something they are. So when the business struggles, it doesn't register as a business problem. It registers as a personal failure. And that makes it incredibly hard, because what they have to do is separate their self-worth from the company performance, and they can't do that. Closely tied to that is imposter syndrome that never really resolves. Every successful founder carries the sense that they're getting away with something, that they don't quite belong in the room, and it's only a matter of time before somebody finds out that they're not who they think they are. So success doesn't always quiet that voice. It often can raise those stakes. Then there's the difficulty of delegating, because so much of the identity and survival instinct is wrapped up in the business. They often struggle to hand things over, even where they're clearly at capacity. And that's really about trust in other people. It's about what letting go means for their own sense of control and safety. There's also decision fatigue, a kind of chronic hypervigilance. Founders are making high-stakes calls constantly, often with incomplete information, a lot of uncertainty sitting in there, and they rarely have anyone above them that they can talk to. If they do that, they spill their beans and they put themselves back into imposter syndrome and all of those other things. So over time, it produces a state of scanning for the next threat, which is exhausting in a way that's hard to switch off even outside of the workplace. And then there's the grief that often goes unacknowledged. There's the pivots, there's the layoffs, there's the failed products, even successful exits all involve real loss. But the culture around founders prizes resilience and moving fast, so that grief tends to go unprocessed and it can resurface later in anxiety, numbness, or burnout. So all of this tends to strain personal relationships, and that deepens the loneliness we mentioned before. It becomes a bit of a feedback back loop. And often they have to sacrifice so much that they find it psychologically very difficult to walk away from a failure path, even when the evidence is clear, because stopping means confronting the cost of everything already given up. I mean, I've recently been approached by a founder who's sitting in this very situation, and it's difficult. It's difficult to manage. It brings that loneliness to the forefront, and the other pressures become so much worse.
Thank you for this very clear picture. Many of those factors I've never even thought about. And, you know, I've never thought of what could come up when you were forced to stop.
Yes, absolutely. Because isn't that the ultimate failure then?
Yeah, it feels like that.
I mean, I've heard one of the founders describe it as this is my baby. Mm. And what I'm doing is I'm having to give this baby up.
Sure. Now, Alta, when a business founder seeks your help, what are the first steps that need to be taken?
So when they come to see me, the first thing I do is an intake formulation. Is that what you're asking here? You want to know how the process works?
Yes, I want to tell you that I had to look up that term, intake formulation. So maybe you could just explain it to the listeners.
It's a very psyche thing that you do, because what you want to be able to do when somebody comes to see you, you want to map what the reality is that is driving the difficulty. So it's not just a surface complaint. It usually has many layers attached to it. So first we want to look at, and this is part of the formulation, first thing that we want to look at is the presenting picture. What's brought them in right now? Is it burnout? Is it conflict with a co-founder? Is it a failed raise, a sense that they're underperforming despite doing everything right? So once they've brought in that first presenting picture, first step of formulation, we then look underneath that pattern. How do they typically respond to pressure, to criticism, to uncertainty? Often that pattern isn't new. It's one that's been running since long before the business existed. Then I look at triggers, what specifically activates the pattern of the founder in terms of their context. Is it investor meetings? Is it board pressure, a co-founder disagreement, or just a slow month? And then finally, what maintains those factors? What keeps that pattern going? Often it's things like lack of sleep, isolation, uncertainty is a big one. Then there's also the culture around them and the rewards that pushes through rather than pausing to be able to notice what is happening. So for a lot of people, they're not even, you know, that you respond to a trigger, right? Mm. If you think about a dog chasing you and looking as if it's going to bite, you're going to run. You're not going to think about that.
Yeah.
Are you?
No, you'll just run.
You're going to just run. And why is this any different? All we do when we're sitting in these situations with new businesses and all of those problems is we get triggered. And those early behavior patterns are the things that are triggered. And so you think you're making a logical choice, but very often there's an automatic response factor in there. Yeah, so important to have a look at those. So that's part of the formulation process. Once I've looked at those factors that are contributing to the reason they're there, the next is to bring in my neuroscience lens. So as I said, these patterns are so automated. So this is when I start looking at what the nervous system is actually doing and whether it's working as it's supposed to under a sustained threat. So part of that is where, you know, that's really formulation process that we use in psychology, and it forms the basis for how we approach what we're going to do in terms of intervention.
Yeah, that makes such a lot of sense. And it just makes me realize once again that when you are in the position of, you know, being the psychologist, how much you have to take into consideration and what a process it is to bring this to the point of clarity where you can decide that you're going to do A, B, and C, or Z, or whatever to help your client.
Yes, yes. And you know, everything hinges on kind of the knowledge that you have in terms of the things that people do under difficult situations, the patterns that people engage in. So understanding and identifying what the drivers are for those patterns is really important.
Yes. I want to ask, before we go on to look at processes you use, when you have these initial conversations with a client, do they find it difficult to answer your questions about the patterns, and is it painful, or how do you approach this in order to create a safe space for the person?
Yeah, that's a two-edged sword, right? Most people are, most of us are protective of ourselves. It's very seldom that you're going to have somebody come in and just let everything out automatically. But we do get to understand where a lot of these things come from. And so we generally have a process that we use in terms of questioning. So we often use what we refer to as intake questions. And intake questions basically start off with getting, as I've said, what the reason is for them being there and examining that, and then stepping it into further conversational exploration of situations that they've had that have been similar in their life. And in that process, you start to uncover what those patterns are. So it's really conversational. And I think the real skill lies in for people to be able to feel that they can trust you, that you're listening to them, and that you're able to kind of judge what's happening with them on an emotional level. So that you can, as a psychologist, you're observing body language, you're observing the emotions, and you are making decisions about whether you need to explore or whether this is something that you just leave.
A quick note on what I do. In my 30 years as a journalist, I've seen how often people seeking health and wellness support feel unsure where to turn for providers who truly resonate with them. Through my articles and podcasts, I aim to offer reliable information while introducing audiences to trusted practitioners and resources. My platform, mariettesneeman.co.za, brings together insights from more than 160 experts on physical and mental health, relationships, and parenting. You're welcome to use the search function or browse the site for relevant information. In fact, you can stream or download any podcast right there on my website, or listen to Calm, Clear and Helpful on Spotify, Apple Podcasts and other platforms. If you're a wellness provider keen on expanding your reach and credibility, let's talk about co-creating a podcast or article, or perhaps featuring you in a South African magazine. I offer a clearly structured process and journalistic insight to help you connect deeply with your audience. If you happen to be a first-time podcast guest, you'll feel prepared before we press record. You'll find more information under Services on my website, or simply send an email to mariette@mariettesneeman.co.za. Thank you for listening to this episode. Now, let's get back to my guest. You implement suitable psychological processes based on the intake formulation. Which processes do you use?
Okay, there are a few processes that I find genuinely, you know, very useful. And as I've mentioned before, I've recently come into brain working recursive therapy. It's one of those things that just resonated with me because I've worked along similar lines previously. These are things that you use kind of the tools of the trade, and then you examine which tools give you the best outcomes. And so you hone the way you work, and sometimes you find something that just resonates, and that's what BWRT, Brain Working Recursive Therapy, did for me. So it is a solution-focused approach, and it's designed to help people change unhelpful emotional responses very quickly. And it works with the brain's natural processing patterns to interrupt those automatic fear responses before they fully take hold. What I like about it for founders in particular is that it doesn't require them to relive distressing memories or go over the history of a problem in detail. You're essentially catching that reaction before it moves past the more primitive reactive part of the brain, and you give them a different response to install in its place. So I'm going to contrast that again with some of the alternative, more traditional models that are all out there, because I also have trained in and use acceptance and commitment therapy, and I'll use hypnotherapy. So yeah, there's a whole gamut of different therapeutic procedures that I use. But your issue with some of the more therapeutic, when you're going too deep into these processes, is that you often reinforce some of those difficulties instead of removing them. And so in this case, as I say, that's why I like the BWRT work. But alongside that, I also use nervous system regulation work. Again, very important for founders to recognize when they've moved into a stress response and to give them the tools to be able to shift out of it rather than think their way out of it, which really works. And then I also work with the pattern itself, not just the behavior that surfaces. So this again can be a combination of therapeutic styles, but It's also available in BWRT. We generally refer to that as situations where often there's a requirement for an identity reset. And so BWRT also offers that ability to do that identity reset. If it's something to do with things that set limits and things that, or situations where people have bad associations with money, that's often instilled from our parents when we're very young, BWRT also offers the capacity to kind of smash those limits and to enable financial success. So there's a whole lot of formulations in that process that are very useful for business founders, and it's fast. So you're not coming into therapy and spending hours and hours that very few of them have. They can come into therapy and things can be sorted reasonably quickly. Yeah.
Alta, could you please give us a supporting case study? Because you've mentioned quite a few things, but I think a case study just helps us to integrate.
With pleasure. So I thought of a case study that I thought would capture this well. I worked with a man this few years ago now. I worked with him before I had BWRT, by the way. I worked with a man running a large, successful engineering business. He came to see me because his wife had noticed a real shift. His stress reactions started to affect his mood, and his sleep was almost non-existent. This man would work until 2 o'clock in the morning and maybe have a couple of hours of sleep at night, and then he's up again and working. So when we unpacked it, the pattern was very stark. He didn't trust his team to do the right thing. So despite having a full staff, he was handling customer inquiries himself, double-checking every piece of technical work, monitoring the entire business, and still traveling constantly for sales meetings. He was also struggling to retain his staff and very negative towards some of his younger employees, by the way, because he felt they couldn't handle what they needed to do. So that, not surprisingly, they didn't stay around. So he had lots of problems keeping them. And that didn't stop at work either. He felt compelled to fill his son's lives with rich experiences that mostly included cycling-based adventures. So even his downtime had no actual rest in it. What made it click for me was tracing it back. It wasn't a business-induced pattern. It was a lifelong pattern. He'd started working at the age of 8. He was a newspaper delivery person at the age of 8 and very conscientious about this. And from there, it never stopped. The business was simply the latest, biggest container for a pattern of hyper-responsibility that had been running his whole life. I didn't have BWRT at that stage, so we worked with mindfulness and ACT and hypnotherapy. So the first thing we did was to reset his sleep and get him to genuinely delegate rather than delegate and check. And we had some very funny experiences with this, because I don't know if you've ever done mindfulness, but in mindfulness, there's a lovely kind of technique to watch leaves on a stream and to leave things that are unimportant. And straight after he tried that technique, he came in and he said, "You know what I discovered? As I saw those leaves floating, I couldn't let them be. I had to go and retrieve them." So that gives you some idea of what was going on for him.
Yeah.
Anyway, as his mental state improved, he didn't just stabilize. He started wanting something bigger. So for the first time, he decided that he wanted to be fully present in his own life rather than managing it from a distance. So he sold the engineering business and started an adventure business instead.
Sure.
Yeah. That case stayed with me because it shows what's possible when you get to the root of the pattern, not just the symptoms. He didn't end up with a slightly less stressed version of his old life, which could have happened if we just worked with the symptoms. He ended up with a completely different one that he built around the very thing the old pattern had quietly been stealing from him, his presence.
Thank you. That was very illuminating. Then my last question is, concerns taking action, because that is a crucial part of moving forward.
Yes.
Do you have advice on that?
Well, I love some of the work of David Rock. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
I'm not.
He takes rigorous neuroscience and makes it usable for people, for leaders. And it's a lovely bridge that is important to build with founders, right? Because of the stress levels. So he uses the following framework that's a choice-based framework. So when a strong threat response kicks in that moment, you actually have three options. You can express it, you can suppress it, or you can cognitively reappraise. I guess you can guess which one works best.
Yes.
So if you express it, if you think about it, that's what a child does, especially when they're very young. The emotion comes out, it's unfiltered. Kids will run off kicking and screaming. I think adults end up raising voices and getting really angry. It might pass through you, but it lands on everyone around you, which obviously isn't workable in a boardroom or with a team you're trying to lead. The second option is to suppress it, and that is what most people default to. They push it down, trying not to let anyone see what's going on with their emotion. And I guess for most of them, it feels like the professional option, but it is actually the most costly. It increases cognitive load, your problem-solving ability drops, your memory suffers, and this is the part people don't expect, people around them can still sense it. Their own stress responses activate even when they don't consciously know why, and that erodes trust rather than protecting it. I think one of the ways in which we can see this is you can sometimes say to somebody, what's the matter? And they'll say nothing.
Yeah.
And you can see on their faces that it's far from nothing. Yeah?
Yeah.
So that's a real erosion of trust that comes with that. The third option, and the one that's really where I focus when I work with these people, is cognitive reappraisal. And sometimes that's referred to as cognitive change. So it's where the real leverage lies. That's when you consciously reframe what is happening rather than reacting to it and hiding that reaction. So it's important to be able to catch that moment when your nervous system starts to escalate and to reappraise before you get to that point where you're going to just let everything erupt or the point where you suppress it. So what it does is it actually protects your thinking, it protects your relationships, and it protects the leader's long-term capacity to maintain good relationships with staff. So in other words, this is where you use calm in your podcasts. This is where calm comes in. When people are calm, they are thinking more clearly, they can deal with situations, they can reappraise the situation, they can look at it from a different perspective, and if they don't know, they can admit that they don't know. It also forms the basis of having psychological safety in the workplace.
Yeah. And now it seems to me we've come, well, not completely full circle, but if one looks at what especially on LinkedIn, many of the conversations there are about psychological safety. And thank you for bringing it to that. Because whether you are a founder or not, that is something that is going to be involved in your day-to-day work, I think.
Yes, and it also leads with some of the other, you know, real founder important factors that you are the person who's responsible for everything. You are the person who has to make those decisions. But I think with that comes the acceptance that while you're responsible, you don't have to do everything. You can delegate. You can allow that delegation. And that's, again, the basis of psychological safety. You have to feel safe enough to know that you can trust the other person, that they're going to do what they need to do and what they can contribute is going to be worthwhile.
Thank you. I'm sure you work online?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. So where can listeners find and follow you?
So, yes, LinkedIn. I'm obviously available on LinkedIn. And I have my website, which is www.rebootpractice.com. And I'm going to get involved in much more social media, Instagram work. So I'll be on there as well. Reboot with Alta. And yes, they can email as well.
Right, and I've got that. It's alta@rebootpractice.com, right?
Absolutely, thank you.
Yeah, I'll also attach the link to your website to the podcast.
Thank you very much. That'll be lovely.
And before I let you go, may I ask you a fun question? You've mentioned, Alta, that you live in an ancient village.
Yes, very ancient.
Yeah. So my question is, if you could have been an inhabitant of this very same village at any period of time in the past, is there a time when you would like to have lived there?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Now, there's some real strange things in this village. I have to tell you that a lioness lived in this village as well.
What?
Yeah. And it belonged to one of the pub owners in the village and is actually buried in the area at this pub that still functions today. And along with the fact that this person had a lioness, he was also the instigator of, you know the circle of death, I think is what they call it, when motorbikes or bicycle people run around like crazy people around a circular surface at speed. That was introduced here, and they still celebrate that. So every year, the circle of death folk arrive and spend a few days demonstrating how insane people can be. So I think that period in this village would have been absolutely superb because this village was one of the areas at the height of the wool trade that was very active in terms of wool sales, etc. And I think there were some, I'm now trying to count them, some five pubs in this tiny little village. So you can just imagine where people spent most of their time. Not that I'm a pub frequenting person at all. Mm. It's just really interesting. Yeah. It would have been a very colourful period.
Yeah. Goodness. I really didn't know any of that. That was quite new to me.
Yep. Weird stuff. That yeah. comes out, yes. We also have here the oldest motor garage that has been running since the beginning of the 1900s. And we also have a local store that has been running for 500 years.
Sure. Now, living in South Africa, that really is out of my reach. Really imagining that.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I guess, one of the lovely things of this part of the world is there's such a richness in terms of history.
Yeah. Thank you, Alta, for that. And thank you for highlighting the challenges business founders face. And I do hope that we can speak about this again, because there's still a lot I'd like to ask you. And in the meantime, it's very comforting to think that there are solutions available.
Well, absolutely. That always is important, that we can find a solution to something. Yeah. And I'm going to ask you a cheeky question as well.
Yes, please do.
When did you first realize that well-being wasn't just a topic you covered, but a lens you lived through?
I wonder whether I've realized it at all.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. I must say, when I was a young mum, and I was a stay-at-home mum at first, and then I started zooming in on wellness at that stage, being concerned with my children. You know, I was a young mum in the time before the internet, so we just had books to learn from. Either you had friends, you had your mother, or you had books. And I think I was concerned with whether my children were happy children. And perhaps that was the time when I started wearing these glasses.
Absolutely. See, the pattern goes way back.
Yes, you caught me there.
Yeah. Lovely.
Thank you for this conversation, Alta. And to our listeners, thank you for spending time with us. If this episode struck a chord with you, I'd appreciate it if you would share it with someone you care about. Go to my website, www.marietsneeman.co.za, for free podcasts and articles on physical and mental health, romantic relationships, parenting, and navigating life's transitions. To follow me on Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, just search for Mariette Sneeman Journalist. The weekly podcast series Calm, Clear, and Helpful is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and other platforms. It's hosted and produced by me, with original music by Mart-Marie Sneeman. Catch you next Tuesday at 9:00.